Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, a member of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel discussing the topic, Are Pesticides Poisoning Our Children's Future? Our first speaker is Susan Kegley, a senior scientist with a PhD in organic and inorganic chemistry from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She also did a postdoctoral fellowship in organometallic chemistry at Colorado State University and the University of California, Berkeley. Before joining Pesticide Action Network North America in 1998, she taught at Middlebury and Williams College, where she began doing environmental research on PCB-contaminated soils. She came to UC Berkeley in 1992 and developed an environmental chemistry course focused on methods to evaluate environmental contamination, including pesticides and heavy metals. She directed PANA's science department from 2002 to 2007, which time she oversaw development of the PAN pesticide database, which is at www.pesticideinfo.org. Their program of technical engineering with pesticide regulatory agencies, and their environmental monitoring program, for which she developed PAN's drift catcher air monitoring device. Her current work focuses on the science and policy related to airborne pesticides. Our second speaker is Gina Solomon, a medical doctor, went to medical school at Yale and had a residency in internal medicine, followed by a fellowship in occupational environmental medicine at Harvard. She's been a senior scientist at the National Resources Defense Council for 10 years, and her work is focused on protecting people from toxic chemicals. She's worked at preventing mercury and lead poisoning, researching levels of diesel exhaust inside school buses, working to ban the most dangerous pesticides, getting nasty chemicals out of consumer products, and helping answer people's questions about health and the environment. She's also been very active working with communities and testing the air, water, and soil in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina to identify toxic contamination that needs to be cleaned up. Our third speaker is Professor Tyrone B. Hayes of the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. His research focuses on the role of steroid hormones in amphibian development. He conducts both laboratory and field studies in the United States and Africa. His two main areas of interest are metamorphosis and sex differentiation. He is also interested in growth, both larval and adult, and hormone regulation of aggressive behavior. He is particularly well known for his studies on the adverse effects of atrazine on frogs. And our fourth speaker is Donique Brumley. She is an environmental activist living in southeast Arizona. She has experienced firsthand the adverse health effects of aerial spraying of pesticides over her home. She has also documented the adverse health effects among the residents and pets in her neighborhood. So I'd like to call Susan Kegley up first to make the first presentation.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I wanted to start the panel off with an overview of some pesticide basics to think about where people might be exposed in their daily lives. First, I'll begin by defining pesticide. Pesticide includes the superset of things that kill other things. Rodenticides, insecticides, herbicides, fungicides. And although people often think that pesticide only refers to something that kills insects, it actually encompasses everything. And these kind of chemicals are found in agriculture, in your hardware stores, in the grocery stores, and they're widely used. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about how, what routes we have for being exposed. And we have certainly food. And for people in urban areas, the food as a source of exposure is probably one of the primary means we are exposed. And also water and air, surface residues, and there are a lot of different sources of this. Residential pesticide treatments, agriculture, if you live in an agricultural area, roadside spraying, something you may not think about, but the next time you drive down one of the freeways, look for that little brown strip beside the edge of the road. They're everywhere. And then there are pesticides applied in many parks, rangeland, golf courses in particular. So I want to go into a little bit more detail on pesticides in food. And this is usually of some interest to people because everybody eats food, and we all have this as a possible source of exposure. There's a very good website called foodnews.org that's put together by the Environmental Working Group. And what they've done is gather all of the data that looks at pesticide residues that you can find in food that's cooked and prepared normally on the grocery store shelves. And so the ones that come up most contaminated most of the time are the soft, easily molded fruits like strawberries, peaches, nectarines, cherries, grapes, and pears. And apples are also in that group. So a lot of the kind of common fruits that we eat every day have the potential to be contaminated with pesticides. Vegetable-wise, your kind of ones that you might choose to buy organic would be things like bell peppers, celery, leafy greens like lettuce and spinach, green beans, potatoes, and carrots. And for a longer list, you should go see foodnews.org. And one of the things that people are always interested in is, well, can't you wash this stuff off? And it turns out that you really can't wash most of these pesticides off. Many of them don't dissolve in water, and some of them are actually absorbed by the plant, so they're taken up into the plant tissue, and you could never wash that off. So this is one of those things where we should all be working towards a sustainable agricultural system that doesn't use these toxic pesticides, and the best way to do that is to support organic as much as you can. Does eating organic actually help? The answer we've gotten in the last 3 or 4 years from researchers at the University of Washington in Seattle, Richard Fenske and his colleagues and Chunqing Liu at Emory University have all been looking at pesticide residues in children's urine. So the metabolites of pesticides, as they're broken down in the body, will show up in the urine. And they looked at children that ate mostly an organic diet and children that ate a conventional diet. And they only looked at one group of pesticides, the organophosphorus insecticides. But what they found was a little bit scary. What they showed was that kids who eat conventional produce have 6 times the levels of pesticide metabolites in their urine as those children who eat organic. And the second study that Liu did was very interesting because they put them on the conventional diet, and then they took them off and put them on the organic diet, and then they let them go back and eat conventional food again. So they saw the pesticides rise with the conventional diet, drop when they were eating organic, and rise back up. And these pesticides are basically, it's showing you that the produce you get in the grocery stores has a lot of pesticides on it. So food's one source. Water is something that doesn't affect us much here in the Bay Area because we get that nice, clean water from Hetch Hetchy. But if you go out into the Central Valley, for example, in Fresno, they've had to close several of the town wells because of contamination by pesticides that are very long-lived, and they're not going to be able to use those wells for a long time. And of course, this is expensive. So pesticides get into water from both runoff from agricultural applications, residential applications, and they're finding that one of the interesting things that's happening these days in the water and pesticides arena is that they're finding these lawn pesticides containing synthetic pyrethroids in sediments in creeks, and they're killing all of the invertebrate life in the creeks. And so it's one of those things where you get rid of one pesticide that's causing some kind of toxicity, and the manufacturers bring in another one, and it causes something different, and we never would have guessed it, or no one's ready for it. And so there are a lot of issues around trying to think about better ways to control pests that don't involve poisoning the waterways. And then the one thing that we've been working on very hard at Pesticide Action Network is the issue of pesticides in air. And this is a very big issue for people who live in the Central Valley. Their air is bad anyway because of all the traffic driving through there. The asthma rates are astronomical, and pesticides are a part of that. So we try to look at both issues related to spray drift, what happens when the airplane flies over and the cloud blows over, and also what happens afterwards. And it turns out that for many pesticides, they evaporate off of the leaf and soil surfaces and make it up into the air. And you can tell this like when you drive by a field and it smells bad. That's what's happening. Those volatilized pesticides are making it to your nose, but they're also making it into your lungs. And so for people who live in those areas, it can be a very big exposure source. And the problem with those kind of pesticides, the volatilized pesticides, is they're absolutely invisible. And some of them don't even have an odor. So you know, maybe getting exposed at times when you don't even know it. This is becoming more of a problem as people build into agricultural land. And if you drive out into the Central Valley, you'll see development after development with agricultural land right next to it. And they're doing what they normally do on the agricultural land, which is applying pesticides on a fairly regular basis. So people have a chance to be exposed there. This is not just an agricultural, a rural area problem. In urban areas, people will often have their houses tented for termite treatments. And the way this works is they'll put a big tarp over your entire house, pipe Vicane gas, a very toxic gas, into the house and let it sit there for a day or two. And then they hook a big fan up and vent it out the window and just run the fan until the house is, you know, vented from exposure to this chemical. So if people live very close, I don't know about in San Francisco proper, but I live in Berkeley, and the offset between houses is about 8 feet. So you have a pretty good chance of getting exposed to the neighbor's pesticide drift there. And then finally, residential pesticide use is another source, particularly for people in urban areas. A lot of people put herbicides on their lawns, or grub control insecticides on their lawns. Golf courses use a lot of fungicides, and no one wants ants in their kitchen. And it turns out that there are lots of ways to get rid of your ants without spraying the really toxic chemicals. And another good place to go to find out information about that is the PANA non-pesticide advisor, which is at Pesticide Action Network is our organization, and it's PANA.org, PANA.org/resources/advisor. So if you want some ideas about ants and roaches, rodents, weeds, those kinds of things. Now, the problem with the residential pesticide use is that you have track-in exposure from the yard into the house. The people who look at where these pesticides end up can vacuum the carpet inside a house of a yard that's been treated and find these pesticide residues. And they get on to the pets when they roll around in the yard. The child sleeps with the pet. It's a pretty big exposure source. And so if the one thing that you as an urban resident can do is to make sure that there are that you're using kind of least toxic methods to control the pests in your own area. So one of the things that we've been doing at PANA that relates to the air pesticides in air is that we've been giving communities, we've developed a pesticide air monitoring device we call the Drift Catcher, and we've been helping communities monitor the air for pesticides in their areas. And we've got projects going, several in California, Minnesota, Washington State, Maine, Alaska, North Carolina, various areas around the country where different communities have come together to try to find out what is in their air and is it there at levels that might be problematic for them. So if you want to find out more about that, you can check out the Pesticide Action Network website. I think I'll stop there. Thank you. And let these guys take over with the help of us.
Thank you for that great introduction. And now Dr. Gina Solomon will give the second part of this panel discussion.
Thank you. In addition to my work at NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, I also work up at UCSF, and I see patients in the Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, and also through the UCSF Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit. And not too long ago, we saw a young man. His name, first name was William. He and his family live in the Piedmont area of Oakland. And he was 12 years old, coming home from school one day. And he was walking up the path to go in the side door of his house, walking his bicycle. And he felt something wet come on, you know, on his arm. He was wearing a T-shirt and on his back. And he looked over, and the next door neighbor was spraying something on the hedge that was between, it was the boundary between their two homes. And he thought that maybe it was, you know, he was watering the hedge, didn't think anything of it. But later on, noticed that he had these funny white spots all over the T-shirt, and the whole side of the house was speckled with a funny white residue. The bicycle was covered with the white residue. Oh, thank you. And they, you know, family was wondering what this stuff was. And the next day, young William had a rash all over his arm and his back. And a few days later, he developed actually an unusual medical syndrome, which was a heart arrhythmia, a rapid heart rate, and ended up being rushed to the emergency room. And that problem continued off and on for a while, and his parents brought him to our clinic at UCSF saying, you know, is this related to this stuff that was being sprayed on the hedge? They ultimately had to get the police department involved to get the neighbor to reveal what he was spraying. Turned out to be a fungicide. The hedge ultimately died because it was covered with fungus. But the neighbor at that point was spraying this fungicide that was available at any hardware store on the hedge. The thing that was, it's always difficult about these cases, is people are saying, well, is this related? You know, is it the pesticide that caused this? And it's really tough to say. The rash, I think we can pretty confidently say, especially given that particular chemical. But what I see, and actually I have one other case I'd like to mention briefly that we also saw at UCSF. This was a woman in her late 60s who had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she came to us because she asked her oncologist whether her decades of work as an agriculture inspector in the Central Valley might have caused her breast cancer. And her oncologist said, I have no idea, go see the occupational environmental medicine specialist. And we saw her, and she described vividly being in the field, you know, at the edge of the field as they sprayed DDT, and, you know, subsequent, you know, multiple generations of different pesticide products over, you know, many, many years. So in the field of medicine and environmental health, we're often grappling with questions of, you know, what's really causing illnesses that people are suffering from? And a lot of patients that we see are saying, you know, is this, you know, I don't have other breast cancer risk factors. Could it have been the pesticides? We know a fair amount about the acute health effects of many of the pesticides that are on the market. And by the way, there are hundreds of different pesticides and different generations of pesticides ranging from some of the older ones, which are, you know, really pretty nasty chemicals, to some of the newer ones that, you know, are at least certainly less acutely toxic, and many of them may be, you know, are using mechanisms that are probably less likely to pose a health threat to humans. When you start looking for chronic effects, health effects, as opposed to acute, start talking about cancer, reproductive problems, long-term neurological disorders, you hit some problems, including the fact that, you know, if I asked each one of you in the audience, what pesticides have you been exposed to during your life? How are you going to answer that question? You have no idea. As you heard, they're sort of a mix of stuff in our food, often used in homes, in the air we breathe, used by our neighbors. There's now the science of biomonitoring, which allows us to actually test for many pesticide residues in human blood and urine. That's giving us some really important information. But since a lot of these pesticides don't linger very long, by the time someone gets cancer, we don't know what they were exposed to 20 years ago or whenever it was that that cancer may have started. But despite all these limitations, there's actually a fairly, you know, robust literature out there finding links that sort of crop up again and again. And some of the main ones are childhood cancers, especially childhood leukemia and brain tumors, have been repeatedly associated with use of pesticides in the home, especially insecticides. We're hoping that that problem may be going away because a whole set of the nastiest insecticides that used to be allowed for use in the home have now been banned just over the last few years, in, you know, around 2000 or so. A lot of, you know, a couple of those have come off the market, and others have now are now being sort of phased out or removed for household use. So we're, maybe that problem will be diminished. There are a lot of studies out there on Parkinson's disease and pesticide exposures. If you live in a rural area, you're more likely to have Parkinson's disease. If you drink well water, you're more likely to get Parkinson's disease. If your occupation happens to be farmer, you're way more likely to get Parkinson's disease. And now some studies have started finding both Parkinsonian-type mechanistic alterations in the brains of rats, and also links in specific studies between certain pesticides and Parkinson's. So that's really important information, and is something I think that is going to, you know, be is important for people to know. And then there's also quite a lot of information now about some of the organophosphate insecticides and effects on neurological development in babies. And these actually are prospective studies where the mothers were recruited during pregnancy and their exposures were followed while they were pregnant and when the babies were small. And they found links between exposures to some of these household insecticides that are also used widely in agriculture, also on food, that were associated with smaller head circumference. It's not a good thing in a baby. Abnormalities in neurological development as those kids have started to get older. Interestingly, you'd think those studies, some of those studies have been actually done in more agricultural areas, but the main study that really put the nail in the coffin here was done in West Harlem, New York. So we weren't talking about farm workers, we were talking about people whose apartments were being sprayed by their landlords. And again, I think there's a lot of good news in the pesticide story that at least in household uses, some of these chemicals are coming off the market. And so what we now need to be thinking about is what's happening in our agricultural areas, what's happening to farm workers and fence line communities, because some of the same pesticides that have been deemed too toxic to use in cities and suburban areas still widely used, aerially sprayed, et cetera, in the Central Valley, and then are coming, you know, to us in the food we eat. So I'll leave it there for now, but I look forward to talking more and to getting your questions about health issues and pesticides. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. And now Professor Tyrone Hayes will address us.
Good. Should I stand on the box? Oh, good evening. I come at this from a slightly different perspective in that my interests are in animals, particularly in amphibian development, and I didn't start out at all interested in looking at pesticides. My interests were in trying to understand how animals, in particular amphibians, responded to environmental change. So in other words, how do changes in temperature or changes in water volume affect development and growth, and how are those changes in the environment inducing those developmental changes? And it turns out that many of those changes are induced, those developmental changes and physiological changes, are induced by changes in hormone levels. And it turns out that many of those hormones, in fact, I would argue almost all of those hormones that regulate development and growth and reproduction in amphibians are synthesized and function exactly and are, in fact, chemically exactly the same as the hormones that are used in humans and, in fact, across the animal kingdom. And in my studies, I became interested, for example, in sex differentiation, in how males and females develop and how they become reproductively active, and found that some of the most important environmental determinants for regulating growth, development, and reproduction were the chemicals that we were putting into the environment. And in particular, I started to study an herbicide called atrazine, a weed killer, and found that exposure to this chemical, atrazine, caused genetic male frogs to develop into hermaphrodites, and we now have data showing that some of these genetic males actually completely turn into females and can function as females and lay eggs, and as far as they know, they're females. And it turns out that as we explored this mechanism further, that the reason that these genetic males would turn into hermaphrodites and females was that atrazine induced an enzyme, it induced the machinery, if you will, that converts testosterone, the male hormone, into estrogen. So in other words, these genetic males were becoming demasculinized because their testosterone was going away, so they would lose their fertility, but then they subsequently would become feminized as well because they would start producing estrogen, the female hormone, because this enzyme aromatase was converting their testosterone into estrogen. Now, what's interesting is it turns out that this enzyme aromatase that converts testosterone into estrogen is present in all animals. Turns out the gene is very similar in humans, frogs, goats, bats, dogs, fish, you name it, because all animals use testosterone and estrogen. And so it turns out, because of this similarity, that even if you take human cells and expose them to atrazine, they will start making estrogen, sometimes when they shouldn't make estrogen. And now multiple labs have shown that this same chemical, atrazine, will induce human cancer cells to express this enzyme aromatase and to start making estrogen. It turns out now that there is at least one study that shows that humans who are exposed to atrazine suffer from a lower fertility, so their testosterone's gone down, just as we've seen in frogs and fish and in other animals. It turns out that in the factory that produces atrazine, this is Novartis, a company of which has also now become Syngenta, in the factory that produces atrazine, the men who work in that factory have greater than an 8-fold increase in prostate cancer. And it turns out that women whose well water is contaminated with atrazine have a much greater likelihood of developing breast cancer. It turns out, in fact, this enzyme aromatase that's turned on by atrazine, okay, so I'm used to working with PowerPoint and pictures, so atrazine turns on aromatase and is associated with breast cancer. It turns out that the same company, Novartis, makes an aromatase blocker to treat breast cancer. So I came at this from looking at frogs and trying to understand frog development, discovered that atrazine causes a hormone imbalance that leads to excess estrogen in frogs, but it turns out the company's actually known this for quite some time. that if you turn off estrogen production, you can reduce breast cancer. But again, the irony, I mean, not a funny irony, is the same company is selling a compound that turns on aromatase and that is associated with breast cancer. What's important for this talk, however, is that the effects that we're talking about now are in adults. When we start to talk about early development, whether we're talking about amphibians or humans, the effects are much greater. What is a little bit of poison in an adult is a great amount of poison in a developing infant or even in a developing fetus. What's interesting now is there's discussions that women who breastfeed might have lower risk of breast cancer. And some of the discussions are that those lower risks might be because women who are breastfeeding are mobilizing those toxins from the breast by excreting it into the milk. But those toxins then, which are in the milk, are going into the developing infant. And the difficulty that we're faced with now, as Gina alluded to, is it's one thing to show an acute exposure and a problem, but much more difficult in humans to show that if I get breast cancer or prostate cancer at 50, that it's related to something that I was exposed to from my mother's milk, or it's related to something that I was exposed to in the uterus that came across the placenta. What's been very helpful in these areas are that we have rodent studies. We have rat studies, which they're mammals like us. They breastfeed like us. They carry their babies like us. And we're now seeing that, for example, atrazine exposure in rats leads to prostate cancer in the females when they're nursing and when they're pregnant, so it crosses a generation. We're seeing that atrazine causes hormone imbalances that lead to breast development problems in the daughters of rats that are exposed, and then those rats even have problems feeding their daughters because their breasts don't develop properly. So we're seeing in rats that we get problems in the grandchildren of exposed rats, two generations down. So the affected rat who has poor neural development and poor growth was never exposed to atrazine, his or her grandmother was. And what you'll often hear from the industry is, well, rats aren't people. I even saw it on Channel 7 just ran a news story, and there was a guy at Stanford saying, well, mice aren't men. But we've seen this already. We have a whole history. DES, which we now know DES causes vaginal cancers in the daughters of women who took it when they were pregnant. We know that DES, or diestylstilbestrol, causes uterine malformations in humans when the mothers were exposed. But we'd already shown that in rats. You can expose a rat, and one, two, three generations down, you still see effects of DES. We already knew that in DDT, it could cross the placenta and affect developing rats. And now in 2006, finally we have a study showing that women who are exposed to DDT before the age of 14 are more likely to develop breast cancer when they're 50 or 60 years old. So we already know that these rat models, and of course the other irony is that these companies use rat models when they're trying to get the chemicals on the market. But then when you find something negative, they argue, oh, it's just rats, it's just mice, it's not relative to humans. So my concern is raised for environmental health, because now we're seeing a global decline in amphibians, and I firmly believe that pesticides are playing a role in that decline, not the sole reason, but playing a role. And I firmly believe that what we're seeing in amphibians and what we can model in laboratory rodents is a warning about public health issues, because many of the developmental processes, many of the hormones are the same. And in particular, I think we need to be concerned about, you know, I've often said with the atrazine issue that we need to take a stand, write to the EPA, write to Congress, and be proactive, not because of us. Essentially, we've already been exposed. And when you're given the half-life of many of these chemicals, our children have already been exposed, and our grandchildren will likely be exposed. So the fight we're fighting now is really, if you look at what we're learning from rats, the fight we're fighting now is really for our grandchildren's grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hayes. And now, Danique Brumley will tell us about what she's experiencing and seeing in Southeast Arizona.
I approach this problem of children with leukemia and adults with leukemia from a totally different direction from the distinguished panel members here. Unfortunately, I've experienced it firsthand. It started 6 years ago. My husband's retired Navy. I was retired. We moved to the Dream Home in southeastern Arizona. And within a short period of time, I got involved with some of the local activities in town. We lived out in the country, up against the mountains. No farming was around us. But I soon discovered that we had children's cancer clusters. Now, I had a child many years ago with leukemia, and I know the pain of that. We had a happy ending. She now has 3 children. But my neighbors, whose children had leukemia, didn't have happy endings for the most part. I discovered that my neighbors also were sick, and that many of them had cancer and related illnesses. And my husband and I thought, my God, what is happening here? What is going on? So we began to try to unravel the problem of why. And of course, the first thing you do is you got chemicals, check your water. It's the first thing we did. And the locals were helpful, but they didn't know what to do, just like we didn't. And so I started out a little bit like Aaron Brockovich. I started beating on doors and asking health questions. And I got my list, essentially, many people that I talked to had the same symptoms. But then I became a little more educated, and I got a list that came from the National Institute of Health with herbicide, namely 2,4-D. Drone has the atrazine, but I was doing the 2,4-D. And 2,4-D is nasty stuff. It's been around since 1930. In fact, they used to put it on the White House lawn. It's in Roundup. It's in Weed Be Gone. It's in a lot of things. The second, farmers use it, number one sales. Forestry services use it to reforest, for reforestation. But getting back to this, I got a list from the VA, Veterans Administration, and it was in their Agent Orange magazine, July of 06. And it was sent to me by the Agent Orange desk in the Tucson VA hospital. And this is, they put their money where their mouth was. They said, okay, if you're still alive and you were in, if you were in the service from 1960 to 1985 and you have any of the following illnesses, didn't matter which branch of the service, did not matter if you were outside of the country or inside, but if you had the following illnesses, bring your doctor's diagnosis, your private doctor, and they would give you $2,200 a month, tax-free, for the rest of your life. So they were fairly certain, and NIH, National Institute of Health, forced them to do this. And these, this is part of the list, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, multiple myeloma. Then we had respiratory cancers of the lungs, prostate cancer, I include breast cancer in that, like Tyrone did, type 2 diabetes, and also chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And with this list and the questions that I began to ask my neighbors, and as I said, I'd go around and beat on doors. Now, my health had been impacted because of me nosing around in this farming community. I was not very popular. In fact, I won't even tell you the name that they called me, but it was a crazy you-know-what. And I'd say, yes, I am a bee, but I'm not crazy. I'm just well-educated. And I said, people are dying. Aren't you concerned? Now, the questions, when I knock on a door, first thing out of my mouth, and I sort of hobble in, because after the first time I personally was sprayed, intentionally, 3 days after, I was wheezing. 10 days later, I needed a wheelchair at the airport, and I had been a runner daily, and this was an intentional spraying of me. But at any rate, when I'd go and knock on the doors very slowly, and I'd say, my health has been impacted, and these were my neighbors, and I said, do you have any health problems? And I'd say, has anyone in your family been diagnosed with diabetes type 2 or have heart problems? So if I got past that, then I would say, how about acid reflux? Have your gallbladder removed? And then I might throw in, like, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, how's your thyroid? Are you on thyroid medication? And your liver on the fritz? Mine is, because I'd be yellow. And oftentimes I would get yes to all of these questions, far too often. And then I would ask the question about Big C, have they had cancer? And one poor lady, she had all of these, acid reflux, had her gallbladder removed, diabetes type 2, and then she finally said, yes, I've had 5 cancers. I've had everything, including my stomach, removed. Now, mind you, this isn't just my community. This is all over the country in similar communities, whether they be agriculture or mine was really non-agriculture, but I'll tell you about the culprit in a minute. Okay, so we have all of these symptoms, and I'm thinking, Lord, Lord, what is this? You know? And then I got my NIH list, and I began to make a map, because now I had cancers that I knew were on a map. This is 3.5 miles in my neighborhood. There's no fields around us. But 44 cancers and related illnesses in 3.5 miles. And we had to know what the problem, what was causing the problem. And that was one individual. It was a negligent spray pilot. Now, what he was doing, he was spraying the fields in the next county, which were an hour's drive away. But when he came back, the airport was 5 miles south of us. So he would fly over the population, and instead of dumping his chemicals elsewhere out in the wilderness, he didn't want to download them and take them to hazmat. So for the 6 years prior to me arriving, my husband and I arriving, and then the 6 years we've been there, he has been dumping his leftover chemicals. Hence, this is what you have. And if you care to, you can download. This is an article that was written. It's www.phoenixnewtimes, which is a newspaper, .com/issues, and it's the 2001 06/14, and then /features, and then HTML. Now, it's Buzz crop dusters spray pesticides on homes, animals, and people, while the Arizona Department of Agriculture does little to stop them. And they actually, in here, this 13-page article, and the guy that sprayed me, he's in here, and they do nothing. We have sent in soil samples. I have been hospitalized by this guy, and we sent in the clothing that the doctor, the clinical exposure, said pesticide exposure. I had chemical burns in my face and my chest. Sent it in to Arizona Ag. Nothing there. Nothing there, including the clothing that I had on. And I had, like you were saying, rashes, lesions all over me. And they ignore it. So this also, which we will talk about later, it talks about in Arizona, checkmate that they're spraying here for the little moth. It's supposed to cause them to mate with a twig, pheromones. Well, in Arizona, we use it to kill the white fly, and here it is. They kill the white fly with it. And the pilot sprayed it on a bunch of fish, and the fish died instantly. They were suffocated. So I don't think checkmate is as delicate on people and benign as they're saying. So that's something to think about. Anyway. I have on that list, there was like 2 kidney cancers in one house. It's not contagious. I had a 60-year-old man and a 40-year-old woman living across the street from one another. You could see where the crop duster came, and on that day he sprayed both of them. The woman who was in her 40s just passed 6 weeks ago from CLL, and her daughter, and the other gentleman, I think, is pretty close. Her daughter, as a result of exposure, ended up with a brain tumor, like we were talking about. In fact, Kimmy's part of her face is paralyzed because of the brain tumor. We have a lot of brain tumors on that map. In fact, just the other day, I added another person that I hadn't heard about that has brain tumors. So when you have things like this. Here's a child. 70% of her bone marrow was covered with leukemia cells. 70%. But she rallied. She's still with us. And thanks to doctors who understand what is going on, and she has been treated. And However, there are other children that didn't make it, and I won't even go into that. Also, I'd like to show you some of the effects of the 2,4-D that are not necessarily on people. They're on animals. And my husband and I have a no-kill cat shelter. We have a very large home. And so when we had a bad storm, animal control started bringing us kitties because they knew we liked cats. And so, and then all the neighbors, and so, you know, we were inundated with kitties. But we're all a bit like the canary in the mine when it comes to the symptoms, because we're sprayed constantly by this fellow. He makes sure that he saves something special when he goes back to the airport. Now, we have 15 minutes east of us is one of the few exceptions. We have a chili pepper farm, and chili peppers, traditionally along with pumpkins, pinto beans, cotton, are defoliated with 2,4-D. And we've had something similar. I'm going to pass these pictures because they're very graphic. It's a two-headed cat, and I got it from the Benson Animal Clinic. She took pictures. They brought it in to her, and it shows exactly what can be, what can happen in the animal world. I'm going to pass these around. We've had kittens at our home. The pilot got me really good in November, and I just writhed in pain. The door, when I went in, was open, and one of our cats, who's been in excellent health, we didn't know she was pregnant, but she had kittens during that time frame, and the kittens were born, and this is not the first time we've had kittens, but these were the worst. They had cleft palates, which is typical for 2,4-D exposure. They had no tongues. That was difficult. My husband went to get milk to feed them and drop it on there because they can't suckle with a cleft palate. And he was like a deer in the headlights. He says, honey, they don't have any tongues. They had little lobster claw front paws because their paws were fused together and the inner one was the only one free. Their stomachs and intestines were on the outside of the body. Now, we've had that before, too. And I begged some of the local vets, just make a little incision and stuff it back in, you know? And, of course, no one would do that because they couldn't. Their hind legs were boneless, like strings. Only one had a cleft or a club foot. Now, I have a cat at home that was born like this with a club foot, and she's the fastest thing on three legs. So, I mean, they do. Had I had that little kitten, the vet put that kitten down, I would not have put the kitten down. I think it would have been very valuable to study. So, this is what chemicals can do. I mean, you're seeing firsthand. Now, there's some other studies, and I'm going to leave you with this thought, that are being done. This is why it's so important for those of us who are aware to make everyone else aware on a grassroots level of what needs to be done. And the state of Arizona is basically a farming community, and I am getting nowhere, absolutely nowhere. So that's one of the reasons why I came here. You, Californians, will listen. Thank heavens. We can start it somewhere. But there's been studies done in July of 06. U.S. Geological Survey team conducted a study to see the impact of atrazine and 2,4-D on the Potomac River and its tributaries, and they came back with some not very nice figures. Again, 50% of the male bass were intersex. And we knew at this point, we were hearing things about the polar bears where there was absolutely no farming, and I said, jeepers, what's causing the polar bears to be intersex? And it was because the polar bears were eating the fish that ate the plankton that absorbed the runoff, which was totally toxic. It was in the food chain. So we have intersex polar bears. Now, another study was completed just the beginning of this year, and it was not only of the Potomac. U.S. Geological Survey team did the same thing. They did the Potomac and the Shenandoah, and they discovered that the male bass in urbanized and farming areas of the Shenandoah, there was 75 to 100% of the male fish intersex. Yeah. And I remember this was the spring of 04, before I got sprayed. And I watched a 10-minute segment on Discovery. I think it was on Discovery Channel. And it was about a group of Spanish-speaking farmers, probably Costa Rica, maybe Mexico, but they were in an isolated little village. And I'm going to show you what happens to people that live in isolated little villages. This is children, okay? Little girls asked to do a picture. Two little girls asked to do a picture in unexposed areas. They were the same age. Now, I'm going to show you a picture of two little girls the same age in chemical, where they were toxified and where chemicals were used in growing areas. This is the same. This is what they did. This is how it's impacting children. In the village that I saw on television, there was another nasty side effect. Everyone in the village, well, a good portion of them, and they accepted it quite readily. At a certain age, they had a celebration, and you got to choose, since you had both sexes, and these were people, you got to choose if you wanted to be masculine or feminine. And this is not well known. I talked to a gentleman who's a well-known artist. He's Yupik and Aleut, and he is gay, because as we were talking about, these are endocrine disruptors. They disrupt the hormones, and the hormones just are going, whoa. And a good many, I said, are a number of your people same gender preference? And he said, oh yes. And I said, how many? You know, 10, 20? He says, many. And I said, really? And he said, but it's okay. He said, our language and our culture has stayed pure for a lot of years because we had nothing to give the white man. And he said, it's okay because this was predicted in our culture years ago. The ancients talked about it. I'll just leave you with that thought.
Thank you, Danique. I would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to a program entitled Are Pesticides Poisoning Our Children's Future? With the distinguished speakers Susan Kegley, Gina Solomon, Tyrone Hayes, and Danique Brumley. Now we have about 15 minutes for questions, and we're going to use the microphone in the aisle. You can line up there and ask your questions. The panelists will answer the questions from the table here. So who'd like to ask the first question?
I'm closest. I'm interested in what the process is of getting these chemicals off the market, like if you could outline what that takes and how that looks. And then I have a lot of questions. One is probably not totally related, but I always wonder about perchlorate, or however you pronounce it, in the water. And then I always wonder about, I have about 10 friends that have MS from where I live, and I believe it's environmental chemical, but are there studies surrounding MS, and can you talk about any of that? Thank you.
Who wants to address?
I could take the regulatory one.
You go ahead, yeah. I might go into Thailand.
Okay. The question was how would you get one of these things off the market? And so far, it's been a chemical-by-chemical process when you really should be able to go in and say this whole class of chemicals has the same type of effect. We know it's damaging, and you should be able to get them all off the market. But in fact, the way the law is written, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act requires multiple processes that give the manufacturers a chance over and over again to contest any banning of their chemical that EPA might put forward. We now have an EPA over the last 8 years or so, 7 years, that is moving as fast as it can backwards in terms of public health protection. So it's been the work that we do at Pesticide Action Network and NRDC, too, basically is putting a finger in the dike until we can get some other things changed. But it's I think, how many chemicals have been actually banned? And they're trying to ban carbofuran now, which is an insecticide that poisons lots and lots of birds. And it's probably going to take at least 5 years from the time the EPA decides to ban it until all the lawsuits are over with. It may take longer than that. And that's the first one in many, many years.
I think we now have about half a dozen lawsuits against EPA for failing to protect kids and farm workers and failing to take into consideration the science that's out there on the health hazards of pesticides. And we have lots of petitions that we've filed to try to get chemicals taken off the market. There is, you know, the whole way that that pesticide regulations works a little bit complicated because a pesticide has to be registered by the Environmental Protection Agency in order to be used. So that's one whole process. And then there's a separate process whereby EPA sets tolerances. And tolerances are allowable residues of certain pesticides on certain foods. And sort of appalling that they allow any residue, but that's the way it's, you know, the law is written. And it is very hard to get pesticides registrations canceled. There are fair number of examples, once the writing is really on the wall and it's all the fights have gone on, of which manufacturers voluntarily, you know, will withdraw a chemical from the market. And so that happens, not often, but it does happen. And then there are definitely situations where specific uses, like household uses, garden uses, uses of pesticide X on apples or, you know, on specific foods, are withdrawn. And we've actually, because in part because of a law that was passed in 1996 called the Food Quality Protection Act, had some successes around specific food issues or even getting some leverage on some of the household uses that I mentioned before, because the manufacturers withdrew the household uses in order to keep the agriculture uses because they were making more money on those. So it's complicated, but you know, I think there's some potential with a new administration and an EPA that actually has interest in enforcing the law as it's written to make some progress again in the future. So I hope that will happen. Your question about perchlorate's a little bit off topic for tonight. That perchlorate is a ingredient in various explosives, such as rocket fuel, fireworks, automobile airbags, that because of its properties, it's a salt, and because of its historical uses, it's been sort of disposed of without a whole lot of care. It's ended up in water supplies in California and a lot of other states. And so there are folks in a lot of areas that are have found out that they're drinking traces of rocket fuel in their water. The reason it's of interest and relevant to today's discussion is that perchlorate actually is known to interfere with the production of thyroid hormone. So it's an endocrine disruptor, but not a sex hormone disruptor. And there are a whole bunch of pesticides out there that also have been shown to interfere with thyroid hormone function in various ways. And so that's a whole important area because not only is thyroid function obviously important for us as adults, but the thyroid is critical for directing normal brain development in the fetus and the infant. Thyroid disruptors have a whole nother wrinkle to them that is, you know, that raises public health concern.
And, you know, just real quickly, part of the problem is that there is no real policy for regulating endocrine disruptors, and the U.S. Congress mandated that the EPA develop an endocrine disruptor program 11 years ago, and I forget how many millions of dollars have gone into it, but for a variety of reasons, there is no program, and there's also been some stalling because a law called the Data Quality Act, for example, in some cases, in the case of atrazine, has stalled even more by various special interest groups saying, well, you don't have a policy, so you can't regulate atrazine and other endocrine disruptors.
Is there any knowledge about a pesticide's effect on multiple sclerosis?
I'm not an expert in that area, but MS is a really... It's a thorny disease. There's a lot of different theories out there about it. It sort of has unusual epidemiology, tends to occur, you know, more likely in young women, more Caucasian women, more in northern latitudes. I actually was wondering, Bill, if you had something to say about vitamin D and multiple sclerosis, because I know that you're interested in that. But there's theories that there may be an infectious agent that's somehow involved, and a lot of interest in whether there might be environmental causes. As far as I know, I haven't seen anything linking pesticide exposure to MS specifically, unless Susan has. But it would be interesting. I actually think there should be a lot more research into that, because it's a really important disease, and I don't think the environmental causes have gotten the attention that they deserve.
Well, my own theory is that it's caused by Epstein-Barr virus and mononucleosis, and that vitamin D can fight the virus and prevent it from going into multiple sclerosis. But that's another topic. But it is a complicated disease for sure.
Thank you so much. I'm learning so much, and it's so frightening. But since there's a short amount of time, I just like to take this opportunity to talk to the local people about the aerial spraying they're planning to do here to us. And a lot of times when we go to this, there's laws that they're going to investigate what's in it or whatever. But I think our really point of power to stop it is through the governor, because he is a political animal. Of course, he's received money from the chemical company, and he's in their pocket and he needs them, probably the mayor too. But they're political animals, and enough of us write a letter to the governor. He does have the power. I thought the state didn't have any power. I thought they had overridden that. But they do. The governor does have the power with his pen to stop this. And if we all write to him, it'll have an impact. And in my purse, I have a form letter, because nobody ever feels like writing a letter. And you can sign it. But I'll also give you blank ones, so that if each of us make photocopies, say 10, and get 10 other people to do it, and tell each of them to tell 10 other people, perhaps we can stop them from doing what we know this thing is going to do to us. But that would be an immediate and powerful thing that we could do and we could spread. And I have them in my purse, so I won't interrupt, but after you can get them from me. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing on a larger scale. It's just, thank you.
Would any of the panel members like to discuss the spraying, the adverse effects and so on?
They used Checkmate in Santa Cruz, and since there was kind of an uproar and people kind of found out it was no good, that now they're saying, well, they're not going to use Checkmate, but they can't tell us what on earth they are going to use. So they have circumvented it. They have a big PR. I think most of you probably already know the situation, you know, how they got $74 million, big chemical company, big agribusiness, et cetera, et cetera. But write that letter. That's what I want to say, because that's how we can at least stop this particular issue.
I downloaded the symptoms the Santa Cruz people had put out. And I put them on the Arizona pesticide exposure report that the ag, when you've been exposed, the ag inspector comes out and he has this little form. Of course, they don't do anything about it, but you get to check it. And the symptoms that Santa Cruz had are on this form, plus 8 more. The only one that Santa Cruz didn't have that was on the executive summary of complaints and recommendations was drooling. I drool. So I knew this, and I thought, oh, well, that's good. So people in Santa Cruz don't drool. Now, a little bit about, I did some digging about Zutera that makes Checkmate. And it's a very strange little company. I've never heard of a company manufacturing only one chemical. I mean, chemical companies are chemical companies. They're supposed to manufacture more than one chemical. And also, you need a manufacturer safety data sheet. I mean, that's just something, and they aren't coming forth with this. What are they hiding? Oh, and they say, well, we keep changing the formulation or this, that, and the other thing. This is against the law, absolutely and completely. And so, since I've been through this, I made it my business to dig around, and I'm understanding secondhand information, but the governor has received campaign contributions from the fellow who owns Sutera. Yeah, and I find this very strange. But what I find the strangest of all is when we were digging for sodium chlorate and organophosphates and all these nasty chemicals that we were coming across with the locals, we came across sodium chlorate was banned. We thought, yay, but only on wheat. It was like, oh, okay, that's not going to help us. But what we received was that there had been on wheat a 2-week emergency exemption in Arizona and Arkansas because it had rained. Now, 2 weeks was a big deal. I've never heard of a 5-year emergency exemption on a chemical that's never been tested on populations. And I can tell you this much. It isn't what they say, because in Arizona, I think I held that up, Checkmate was used in conjunction with another nasty chemical, but it was used to kill the common whitefly. And it says it was sprayed over a cotton field to kill the common whitefly. It didn't say confuse its hormones. It says to kill. That bothers me a lot. The other thing that we can do, if I may add this, there is a gentleman in this state who is the grandfather of chemical exposure. He wrote the book. His name is K-A-Y-E-H, as in happy, Kilburn, K-I-L-B-U-R-N. And this gentleman is a cardiologist, and he lives in Pasadena. In fact, you can go through residential information and get a hold of him under K.H. Kilburn. He wrote the book Endangered Brains, of which I held up the backside of it. Now, this gentleman developed a 5.5-hour neurological test for people like myself and others who have had their lives ruined by chemical exposure. And attention deficit syndrome and a lot of other things are in this. But at any rate, this gentleman, if you can send the people in Santa Cruz to him, or anybody who has had their lives, they complain about these symptoms. These are the very symptoms that he tests for. And have the test, this neurological test, you can go through a toxicologist and say you want Kay Kilburn's neurological test. It holds up as evidence in court. So there is something that you can do.
Anybody else want to talk about?
I'd like to take a crack at that one. The light brown apple moth, the California Department of Food and Agriculture has blown it again in some ways, but it is a real problem for agriculture to consider the possibility that all of the California produce will be quarantined and not allowed to be shipped anywhere else, even in the U.S., much less out of the country. So it's an issue that is a serious one, potentially, but CDFA hasn't shown us that. They haven't shown us what the extent of the problem is, what the extent of the economic damage might be if they just leave the moth alone, and instead are relying on this pheromone they're going after eradication when they've never been successful in eradication before, so let's don't call it that. and they still don't get the fact that people don't like the idea of being aerially sprayed. Mm-hmm. It reminds people of the military and Agent Orange and Vietnam and all of those things where some authority is trespassing on your rights as a citizen to know what you're being exposed to. So CDFA has taken this approach that is not sitting well with everyone for all kinds of very good reasons. They have, however, chosen chlorpyrifos as the control agent, which would have been very bad and much worse than the pheromone that they chose. We still don't know what the toxicity of that pheromone. There's not been tests on it. It's assumed to be not very toxic because of its chemical structure and how that's similar to other chemicals. But you're absolutely right. We don't know. So it's a complex issue. Pesticide Action Network has a pretty good website up on that kind of looks at these complexities.
Yeah. And just to
UC said that pest is a very minor pest, and the trade agreements, they've made it a major issue. They created that trade problem themselves and correct that.
Yeah, I certainly am not an expert on the moth and how dangerous it is as a pest and so forth, though I do know that they're talking about quarantining California produce, which is alarming if that really were to be the case. I did, the company and the Department of Food and Ag did actually ultimately release a full list of ingredients in this product. It took a little pushing and doing for that to happen, but last fall they put that out. And I took a look at the list of chemicals. And I got to say, you know, based on my expertise and my, you know, background in toxicology, that there weren't things on there that raised big red flags or alarm bells. There, you know, it was basically a mixture of chemicals that would sort of, types of things you'd actually tend to find in something like dish soap, but that, and, you know, and including urea. So I told people, well, it's sort of like a mixture of dish soap and pee. It's not very appealing to have them aerially spraying that, but it's not, you know, in the scope of things. We have the history of them doing aerial spraying with malathion for the medfly, spraying all kinds of incredibly toxic insecticides for the glassy-winged sharpshooter, including chlorpyrifos, which is, you know, one that we're really trying to get off the market and that kills people. And over those years, you know, both all of the sort of pesticide activist groups have over and over again been saying, you know, if you have to control these things, don't use the killer insecticides. Use pheromones or other more integrated pest management approaches. And this time, they're actually sort of kind of trying to do that. They're doing it in a sort of a clunky, blundery way with horrible sort of public participation and stuff. And so people still are really outraged. I think that this is a great opportunity, if we can, to get people to think about, you know, what's going on every day in the Central Valley, where they are being aerially sprayed with really horrible stuff. But, you know, I've taken some flack for this position because, you know, people expect that a group like NRDC will come out strongly in opposition to the apple moth spraying, and instead we've actually expressed concerns about the spraying but have not opposed the spraying process. And they, CDFA actually put some quote from me from kind of out of context on their brochure to sort of support their program, and I said, please take it off the brochure. I don't feel that comfortable with what you're doing. But on the other hand, I do want to say, you know, this could be a lot worse.
You didn't put checkmate on the checkmate on Santa Cruz. Didn't you say checkmate's real bad? You put checkmate on Santa Cruz.
They do have the MSDS up on the website. And it's actually, there may be another product named Checkmate. But this one doesn't have any, I mean, there's basically no adverse effects listed in the MSDS. So it really is kind of the best of a choice of, if you're going to use a chemical approach, the way they're delivering it, not good. Nobody likes that. And there's all kinds of good reasons for that.
You know, I guess also there is an alternative way to deliver it, I understand, with the ties where it wouldn't be dispersed. Mm-hmm. And I guess I sort of agree. I've sort of taken the same position, and you know, because I was asked to testify and things like that, and granted, there are, for some of the inert ingredients, you simply can't find information. And I guess the one thing I am opposed to is sort of the idea that you know you'll often hear them say, well, there is no data to suggest that this is harmful. It doesn't necessarily mean it's safe, but they're suggesting that the absence of data means safety, and that I sort of disagree with. But I sort of take the same position that you guys have expressed. And the other reason I take that position is when I think about, for example, chemicals that may be harmful, and when I say things like we can't afford the weighted generation of 40 years to figure out that we have to sort of use a precautionary approach, I sort of feel like I have to take that position to the farmers who, we can't wait till the moth gets here, and then they're really going to pull out something bad. So we can't wait to see if it's really going to be a big problem. We have to act.
Scientists said that that moth is not a big problem.
Maybe well, if I could ask a question about
yes.
Sally. Is that, thanks. I was just wondering, as a Californian, and there's a lot of concern about aerial spraying and people are getting mobilized, if you could, as people that have been working for so long in California, identify some of the key messages that people could put in some of these letters that are concerned about aerial spraying. Like, what are some of the major priorities for pesticide reform in California that people could lay out as we contact our politicians about what we're concerned about? Thank you.
I'll take that one. Well, a lot of the bills, there are a number of bills that the Bay Area legislators, and there's a handout in the back that summarizes these, they put together a package of bills around this issue of the light brown apple moth spraying. The one I like the best is that there needs to be a two-thirds majority vote to approve any kind of activity like this. And so kind of the idea of right to know, if you're going to be contaminating our environment with something, we need to know what it is and what its health effects are. And I think that is one of the main messages that should really get out there. And then the other one is find out if it's really a problem before you go to such extreme measures. And I think there's a lot of comments in that direction from this, at least the city of San Francisco is like, you know, well, let's... If you're doing a CEQA, a California Environmental Quality Act analysis, you have to have alternatives. And one of the alternatives is, you know, you have to have what the problem is, you know, research into the extent of the problem. And so I think that's another thing that you could point out is let's find out what the problem is before we go spraying lots and lots of chemicals on people's heads. And I don't know. Those are my
Well, unfortunately, I think we reached the end of our allotted time here. We'd like to thank our speakers on the topic, Are Pesticides Poisoning Our Children's Future? We had Susan Kegley, Gina Solomon, Tyrone Hayes, and Danique Brumley speaking on this topic. So with this, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is over.